with the latest on the COVID, it seems I've been trying to find out, as you know, we learned a month ago that 15 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine had been compromised. They were contaminated. Since then, I was trying to find out what the contaminant is. Now, there's been a lot of fog, you might call it, in information. But one things that we have learned is that it seems the company that was actually manufacturing the COVID-19 vaccine for Johnson & Johnson is a company called Emergent Biosolutions. And it seems also this was not the first time. I didn't know that. It's only because of this that we learned that they were also making the AstraZeneca vaccine and shipping them to Europe. And it seems that back in October, they had to stop 3 to 4 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine that they were about to ship because of contamination. Now, fast forward to April 1st, these so-called contamination that they've said of the Johnson & Johnson, they said it was contaminated. There was a mix-up, and some of it, some of those Johnson & Johnson vaccines were contaminated with the AstraZeneca vaccine. There was a mix-up of the two vaccines, which makes one wonder, and I had wondered that with you before, if they detected 15 million contaminated doses, there must have been a lot that was not detected. Well, an article from the New York Times now is saying that there was probably 62 million contaminated doses. Now, if those were shipped out and people were vaccinated with them, we don't know. The company is being very opaque and not transparent at all in saying what the contaminant was. Now they're saying, well, some of them, there was a mix-up, and the AstraZeneca vaccine, which, by the way, is a simian adenovirus as a vector for the antigen, for the COVID-19 antigen, whereas the Johnson & Johnson is a human adenovirus, and I think serotype 5 human adenovirus, that is used as a vector for the antigen. And furthermore, inspection of these of Emergent Biosolutions of their installation in Baltimore reveals some major flaws. And it seems I'm not the only one who worried about that. A certain Dr. Hussein, who was an inspector, one of the FDA's point men in and from 2000 to 2005, remarked in this article that these were fundamental mistakes. And if there is such fundamental errors that were committed, one wonders what other errors were committed in the manufacturing of the vaccines.
Okay, so, you know, you can understand maybe if one or two batches of vaccine or maybe get contaminated with something, since so many millions are being produced, but surely not, you know, 15 million and even more millions of some sort of accidental contamination. It does make you wonder whether they're just rolling this stuff out as fast as they possibly can without doing the proper checks.
That is absolutely correct. It's the only correct conclusion. Like I said, you know, this figure of 62 million was published in the New York Times. That 62 million doses may have been compromised. what was done with them, the article does not pursue. But they do quote Dr. Hussein in saying that the methodology mistakes that led to this were very fundamental mistakes in vaccine production, and that if something like this happened, there are probably many other errors that were committed in the production line.
Well, that's, I mean, it's coming from one of the former regulators themselves. So this is pretty damning stuff. I mean, you know, I've been suspicious, Stanley, right from the start, the way that this vaccine has been sold as a kind of magic bullet, you know, this amazing knight in shining armor that everybody has got to get behind it. And it's almost like a kind of advertising campaign.
It is. It is. And I think we're making a fundamental error in combating this corona, SARS corona 2 virus.
Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make is that this is on the news bulletins. And yet, actually, it's like almost like a soap powder advert. But they're presenting it as if this is, you know, critical journalism.
Well, unfortunately, the journalists are not asking questions. We have a big problem with journalism. And this is one of the reasons you are one of the rare true investigative journalists around. Most of the mass media, or the New York Times and the Washington Post, are just bullhorns for, you know, official declarations. They're not really, it's rare to see good investigative reporting.
I mean, we've been getting, I don't know about in the United States here, we've been getting sort of film of people who've just had their vaccine sitting on a chair in front of the camera saying how fantastic they feel. Although, you know, most times when I've had vaccines in the past, I certainly haven't, you know, felt fantastic for having it straight away afterwards. And a lot of it seems to be psychological. In other words, it's kind of emotional rather than in any kind of real critical thinking, Stanley.
Yes, there's this emotional response, and a lot of people who are saying how great they feel, well, obviously, the news media will not show you those who said, I felt sick for 2 days or I felt sick for 3 days. Normally, the day after the vaccine, you should have some kind of an effect, because if you don't have an effect, then the vaccine probably wasn't effective. My advice is that if you were vaccinated, if you received the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is what is prevalent in England and in Europe, in continental Europe, is about a month later, go have a serum neutralizing antibody test. See if you have neutralizing antibodies. And this is a very simple test that can be done for $5. The kits are sold where you put one drop of blood in a well and the antigen in the other is already in another well, and you get a precipitation band in the middle. It takes about 10 minutes. If you do have precipitating antibodies to the antigen, to the viral antigen, then you know the vaccine worked. But if you're negative, that means the vaccine didn't work. You're not really protected. It seems that right now, remember when we spoke about the British variant? And I told you that this was obviously a probable mutation. They had put bans on travel. All people coming from Great Britain should be quarantined. Well, this was a natural mutation, which after a while was detected in 83 countries. Then the latest was the Indian mutation that was detected in India, and now it's in 35 countries. Obviously, this is not people who travel from India to 35 countries that took it there. It's just these mutations are just first detected in a country. They brand it with that country's name, But sooner or later, you're going to find that same mutation other places because in the reactions of the RNA of the virus, it's thermodynamically easy for that reaction to take place, for certain nucleic acid to be replaced by others, and you get a mutation. Because every three nucleic acid, this is basic biology, codes for one amino acid in the protein antigen. And so if you have a virus that is mutating and presenting different antigenic structure for which the original vaccines that were developed, may not be effective, and now we hear that Pfizer is talking about revaccinating every year, it would be much better as a strategy to develop an antiviral that will stop the virus in its replication. We know how the virus replicates. We know that it has to be replicated by what they call RNA polymerase. We know that it has to assemble the capsid around it. And all these different steps, we can find things that blocks it at different steps of replication. And I think that would be a much more, with a virus that they pretend is constantly mutating, and therefore you might have to be vaccinated every year, it would be much better to find an effective antiviral. And not much money is being allocated to researching for antivirals that will block the virus replication. Obviously, that would be a more permanent solution, but I suppose it's as far as monetary profits are concerned, it's better to be introducing a new vaccine every year, like they've done with the flu vaccine.
Well, that's my question to you, Stanley, is how successful has the flu vaccine been over the years? I find some people telling me, for example, that they've had a flu vaccine and then they've actually had the flu in a bad way, or that the vaccine hasn't protected them, and later in the year they've caught the flu. Some people saying that they don't notice the vaccine, but this idea of having an annual flu vaccine and the pharmacy phoning you up and saying it's time for your flu vaccine, how do you think that's actually rolled out? Because obviously these things are put forward as a great thing to the medical regulators. But how has the flu vaccine actually transpired over the years?
Okay. Well, if you look at the statistics from 2010 to 2019, you're going to see that one of the best years was around 2012, when only 17,000 people died from the flu in the United States. I'm not talking globally. I don't know the global figures, okay? Now, in 2017, there's been a campaign, and every year you get progressively more people getting the flu vaccine. In 2017, and you're going to notice that 2010 was a low year, and then it has increased to 40,000, then decreased again in the following year until 2017, which was the worst year, yet had higher vaccination rates than the previous years, where we had nearly 80,000 deaths from the flu season.
Now that's immediately worrying, isn't it? Because you've got a whole flu vaccination program going on, and yet it doesn't seem to be doing anything to bring the levels of flu deaths down.
Well, that is precisely it. If you look at the statistics from 2010 to 2019, you will see that there isn't really a correlation in the number of cases, that is morbidity or mortality, the number of deaths, with the percent of the population that's vaccinated. The percent of the population that's vaccinated has been constantly growing through their campaign of through their vaccination, the official, you know, vaccination campaigns.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems intuitive that if that percentage is growing, then the number of people dying of flu should be dropping. Is that the case or not?
It is not. That's what I'm. That's exactly what I'm telling you. That there is no correlation between the number of people who got the vaccine and a reduction in morbidity or mortality. And that's why I brought this example of the difference between 2010 and 2017. And 2017 was one of the worst years for hospitalization and deaths from the flu vaccine.
Okay, so can you just explain the difference in those terms, Stanley, morbidity and mortality?
Morbidity is how many people get sick. Mortality is how many people die. And these, you know, like I said, there is no correlation between the percentage. As the percentage of people who are vaccinated increases, there should be an accompanying decrease in both hospitalization and deaths.
Well, you would hope so. But I mean, I put it to you that actually the flu vaccine has been a failure, and that maybe the vaccine firms realize that, and they realize that sometime soon people are going to wake up to this, and that they need a kind of some sort of new vaccine which they can, you know, start to make money out of, vaccinating people annually with something different, because the flu vaccine seems to have hit a dead end.
Well, the way they explain that, the way the their explanation, which is almost idiotic, is that sometimes the flu in the middle of the year mutates, the flu virus, the influenza virus mutates after they had done the vaccine for that year. Therefore, it wasn't as effective as the year where the influenza virus did not mutate during the vaccination period.
Yeah, but I mean, you could say that's idiotic, but that just might be the case. You know, that sometimes you're vaccinating people for a strain of flu that is very quickly gone and replaced by another one. So they're having a go at it, but they're just not managing to get it out there in time. And I suppose there is the other thing, is that it actually does take a while, as I understand it, to develop these flu vaccines anyway. So once you've got a flu strain that's out there, you're developing a vaccine for that. It's not as if you can click your fingers like that and suddenly the thing is ready for market.
Definitely. But what we should be seeing is a steady decrease if the flu vaccination campaign was effective. We should have been seeing a decrease, you know, a constant decrease every year in the number of flu sickness and flu deaths. And we're not seeing that. Look at the statistics. You'll see up one year, down another year. It's like a zigzag curve. And 2017, it spiked really way up, went down in 2018, sort of plateaued in 2019. And in 2020, the funny thing about it is that it went drastically down. And yet, a lot of people didn't go get their flu vaccine in 2020. The percentage of people who were vaccinated for the flu decreased in 2020 due to the restrictions in movement because of the coronavirus. Yet 2020 is almost a miracle, almost the disappearance of most respiratory viral sicknesses, and even intestinal viral, what they call intestinal flus.
Okay, so what do you put that down to? What are the possible explanations?
Well, the explanation that was given is that the precautions that were taken for the coronavirus is what literally you could say, due to the few numbers of flu that we saw, almost eliminated the flu epidemic for the flu season of 2019-2020. But it's a good theory. But what I'm wondering is that since the influenza virus is the same size in diameter as the coronavirus, they're between 110 and 130 nanometers in diameter. Secondly, they're transmitted the same way through droplets in the air from person to person. Yet these precautions managed to eliminate the flu, but not eliminate the coronavirus. To me, that is kind of mysterious.
One of the things that's been being talked about quite a lot, Stanley, and we did touch on this in one of our previous interviews, is the use of biological agents as weapons. So in other words, the deliberate release of them in order to either injure or kill an enemy. I wonder, what do you make of that what do you know about the history of the use of that, particularly in North America? Because or in South America too, because as I understand it, this was deployed really as a method of genocide, which equals something like the Holocaust in terms of the number of people being killed by it. So I wonder what you make of the some people who've been saying that it's feasible that this virus was released in a similar manner for ulterior motives that we may not know.
I don't believe that. That would be a very bad biological weapon to use, because its mortality is in the general population of all ages is less than 1%. So why use something like this as a biological weapon? Whereas smallpox, which was used here in the United States against the indigenous people, in Brazil until the 60s and 70s, they were intentionally spreading the pox virus, the smallpox virus, to clear the forests of indigenous people, the rainforests. This is well documented. But the coronavirus as a weapon that would not be an effective weapon.
To me, what about just as a biological warfare experiment, just to see how successful such a thing could be? And of course, they might be also looking anyone that would release such a thing. And I don't think we're necessarily going to be able to nail that one tonight. But as a sort of psychological operation too, to see what might work and what might not work in terms of impact on society.
Well, we just had a very interesting hearing here in the U.S. Senate yesterday, and there was a heated exchange between Anthony Fauci and Rand Paul, the Republican out-of-the-box senator, who is the son of Ron Paul. They're more libertarian than Republican. Anyway, he was drilling Fauci precisely about that. Why, how come we had sent money to the lab in China? How come? And Fauci was explaining that the SARS Corona-1 infection had come from bats in China, and that they were simping to experiment to find ways to prevent another outbreak like SARS-CoV-1. The end result was not that great, because we have an outbreak that makes SARS-CoV-1 look like a very minor epidemic compared to the extent of the pandemic of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So is it a new strain that mutated in bats that came out, or is it experiments with the SARS-CoV-1 through serial passage in tissue cultures, which is absolutely normal. I did that with my virus in order to have stock virus preparations. Did it mutate in vitro, in the laboratory, and then accidentally released? Or did it mutate in vivo, in nature, with bats, and then contaminated through the supposedly live markets that they have? Both are possibilities.
What about the effect on fertility? Because this has been being also discussed quite a lot. It'd be nice to get your steer on whether you think it's feasible that that COVID-19 might possibly affect fertility in men, and, you know, either men or women. But I think particularly the concerns have been about women.
I don't think the coronavirus can affect the reproductory process. Of course, it will affect it while you're sick, but I don't think, up to now, there is no scientific proof that it would render a large portion of the population sterile, women sterile. There was a case in Africa when certain vaccines that were sent to Africa also contained sterilization products in them to render women infertile. And this is, again, this is documented, and you can see that. So it's more likely that if one wanted to sterilize large populations of women, whether in Asia or in Africa or who knows, or in Europe, it would probably be in the form, not in the form of a coronavirus, but perhaps in the form of a vaccine to a coronavirus.
I mean, is that feasible?
It was done before.
Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about that case before?
Well, it was a case in Africa where they were sending vaccines. I think this was in the 90s or early 2000s. And a lot of women became sterile. And
what did they think they were being vaccinated for?
Back then, I can't remember, to tell you the truth.
Okay. Well, that certainly is. I mean, it seems to be the place that the Western pharmaceutical industry go to experiment on humans, Africa, because there's been some horrific stuff going on there, including, I noticed, Pfizer regularly having vaccine trials that they said had already been tested, but they hadn't. And then when people start getting sick and ill, they have large slush funds in order to bribe politicians and bribe judges and bribe the courts, etc., in order to make sure that they don't get prosecuted in their national system. But look, one of the things as a journalist I often think about is what we don't know. And I suppose that is what we might call transparency or lack of it by these vaccine manufacturers. So I wonder, what is it, do you think that, you know, that they are not telling us? Because there seems to be, I mean, we've already heard about, you know, certain ingredients in vaccines, which they don't want to talk about. Does that concern you? And is there anything there that you think that we really do need to know as people who are receiving a vaccine or any kind of treatment that drug companies are keeping rather too close to their chest? Because we've got to have, you know, we've got to have disclosure. We've got to know what we're letting ourselves in for if we're going to have any kind of real informed consent.
Well, most pharmaceutical companies, when they develop a drug, they call it, first of all, they patent it, and then they call it their intellectual property. And releasing exactly how it's done, for example, the Moderna virus or the Pfizer virus or the AstraZeneca, the procedures that go and all the ingredients and how it is done, you know, is kept as intellectual property. And we as a society have accepted that state of affairs. for a long time, where a company, you know, develops, it's tested, it goes through the supposedly rigorous testing, the FDA approves it.
Well, hang on. I'm going to stop you there. Stanley, I'm going to stop you there because the thing is, a lot of this testing is actually done by the company themselves. So, you know, there's got to be some questions about how reliable it is.
Of course there is. And this has happened since the 80s when we had a revolving door between the FDA and the pharmaceutical companies. You have, you cannot have the Food and Drug Administration being run by people who came directly from the pharmaceutical companies, and in many cases, after their tenure is over at the FDA, return to the pharmaceutical companies. This is a conflict of interest that started in the 80s and that is now rampant. It's just I said, the same for the financial institutions. How, you know, here you have here in the United States the same thing. People from Wall Street becoming the Secretary of Finance and then going back to Wall Street after, or even as Attorney General and then going back to Wall Street.
I think one of the most pernicious sides of all of this is the way that the multi-billion, some might even say trillion-dollar pharmaceutical companies are not prepared to back up their vaccines with indemnity. In other words, that if something goes wrong, that they just turn their back on the people who've had whatever vaccine or whatever treatment it is, and they say, well, actually, the government is going to have to pay for this, which means it's a little bit sneaky, really, because it means that if anybody wants to sue in court, they're taking the government on. They're not taking a private business on. And of course, the government is far closer connected to the courts and the appointment of judges and the court process than a company is. So you're not likely to get such a good result from suing the government as you are from suing the company itself. So can you just explain how this has happened? Because it just seems to me it's just totally and utterly wrong that if you or one of your loved ones is damaged by a vaccine, that the company that's produced that vaccine and tested it, etc., and said it's safe, is not liable.
By the way, you're right as far as the COVID-19 vaccines are concerned, but you're wrong about them not setting aside money for lawsuits. If you check, you'll find out that pharmaceutical companies pay an average of $2 to $3 billion a year in damages. Now, they've been rendered immune because of the fast-track order, because of the great emergency for COVID-19. They are immune from civil or criminal prosecution. It was their condition for producing it fast and without proper testing for 3 years minimum, which it would normally take to test the vaccine. These went on a fast track production. They skipped a lot of trials to make it available sooner to the public. And what they asked was immunity from civil lawsuits.
Okay, so do you think it was justified to have this fast track? Do you think that the SARS-CoV-2 virus was dangerous enough to accept that? Because it's quite an exceptional procedure to bypass the proper safety checks for something which is being injected into millions of people.
I agree with you. I don't think the lethality of the COVID-19 vaccine, of the COVID-19 virus, required such a step. But then that's my opinion. You had something that had a very low mortality rate. So I don't think there was any reason to really skip some of the safety measures in producing a vaccine and making it available to the general public.
Okay, so if the mortality rate wasn't enough to justify it, why did they do that then, do you think?
You know, sometimes people answer a question by saying this is above my pay grade, but what I'm going to tell you is that I think they did it because of the general panic that gripped the world concerning the coronavirus. I want to point out an article for you that the poorest country in the world, Haiti, had minimal corona deaths, about 50. And yet no masks were used, no vaccination. The government decided there will not be vaccination in Haiti. And yet the population was barely affected. There are many, I've spoken to many physicians in Haiti, and they told me they think that one of the reasons this virus did not affect the Haitian population is because of the chikungunya virus that a lot of them had developed antibodies to that perhaps cross-reacted. They attribute it to perhaps cross-reaction with malaria, or perhaps taking chloroquine as malaria prevention also prevented a bed epidemic. Now, as far as the chikungunya virus was concerned, that explanation is not sufficient because there are other places where that virus was prominent, such as in the Dominican Republic next door, where they had many more cases of COVID-19 than in Haiti. So that remains unexplained. But Haiti has the lowest mortality per 100,000 than any other country in the world. It's a very congested place. The demographically, it's a very dense population. Yet they celebrated Carnival, Mardi Gras, as if there were no virus like any other year. And yet they did not have huge outbreaks of, morbidity or mortality. So here's one thing that remains a mystery. And a couple of articles were written about that last week, by the way.
Oh, okay. If you'd like, if you can fill us in on that, because it is fascinating. Haiti is notorious as having a very poor healthcare system, and yet it seems that it somehow has dealt very well. My instinct is that perhaps maybe we here in the West, with all our super cleanliness and our obsession with health, has meant that we've been rather mollycoddled, and that because the Haitians are subject to many diseases and they've had to build up natural immunity to these things, that perhaps they're better prepared.
Possible. It's very possible. It's such a glaring thing that our local ABC channel in Miami here, Channel 10, had a special report on that. Unexplainable it is that Haiti was not, and yet a lot of people from Miami traveled to Haiti, and most of the cases in Haiti was among the wealthier classes and with very, very low mortality.
Well, I wonder whether perhaps they're, using some of these, one of these cheap drugs like ivermectin, perhaps.
In Haiti, it seems all of them believe in what they call armoise tea. They seem to take it regularly. They don't even have to pay for it because it grows in the wild. And they make tea with it. And it seems... they attribute it to that, but there is no scientific cause and effect showing that this armoise tea is what did it. It's possible, but I don't want to say anything that, you know, where cause and effect is not proven, but it's possible.
Okay, well, we've spoken before about ivermectin. This is really the big scandal, I think, of the COVID experience, is that it's still being blocked in many countries and doctors being threatened for using it, even though it's been proven as a fantastic effect that it has on COVID, particularly at the early stages. You know, and this is in proper random controlled trials and all sorts, have shown that this stuff is really good, but it's very cheap. Notice that Merck, it was that had the patent for ivermectin, this drug that was invented, I think it was in the 1970s, which is an antiparasitic drug. It kills worms and this sort of thing. And but it just so happens that it has this effect. Now, let's look at the reasons for Merck then deciding to release the patent. So they weren't able to make enough money from it. It wasn't that that they couldn't make any money. They could, but they weren't able to make enough money to satisfy the returns demanded by shareholders. So, I mean, this to me is one of the things at the heart of this pandemic has been the failure of the medical system to actually deliver what people need in order to cure. It seems to me as if it's driven much more by profit margins and by returns to shareholders than it is to clinical decisions, Stanley.
Well, you can see how much the astronomical profits that are involved. Pfizer, in the first 3 months of vaccination, reported profits of $900 million, almost $1 billion. In the first trimester of vaccination. Most people are saying, well, we're getting vaccinated for free. No, you're paying for it. You're paying for it with your tax money. And these companies are not giving it away for free. A lot of people are under the impression that because they're getting vaccinated for free, that those companies are not making money out of it. Well, the financial releases of Pfizer shows that in the last trimester, their profit was $900 million. Almost a billion with their vaccine. So there is a lot of money to be made in vaccination, especially if you make it a yearly thing. And that's unfortunate that we have such controversies, because immunization is very important. Since Louis Pasteur, we've shown that immunization is extremely important. And whether it's for the three principal vaccines we got as children, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, death from diphtheria was terrible among children and heartbreaking. And vaccination has practically eliminated that. Same thing for smallpox and for poliomyelitis. Unfortunately, now in the new world, the greed of these companies have made people become doubtful about every vaccine. Precisely because they've put profit above everything else, both in this manufacturing of this vaccine, and second, in, I don't know if you've noticed that, but now vaccines are coming out for everything. Things that were never vaccinated for before, things that perhaps letting natural immunity take care of it would be better.
So how do we decide whether to actually start preparing a vaccine for people, as we did in the case of COVID-19, and whether to actually let people catch a disease, or maybe just simply boost the immune system so when they do catch it, they get better? So, for example, with measles, young people don't have a problem with measles. They just catch it and they shrug it off. Whereas, you know, maybe somebody of a very young or elderly age, it might be more dangerous. So how do we make that decision? It's an enormous decision and big question to ask you, Stanley, but I wonder if you can paint some of the, the sorts of decisions which are going through the minds of the very best doctors in making the right decision for the largest number of people.
What's good for the largest number of people may not be good for individual cases. So it's a question of knowing, for example, if you're going to get vaccinated, a lot of people are associating the vaccines with autism. It's a question of individual choice. I don't think some of those vaccines should be mandatory, which unfortunately they've made them mandatory in the States in order to go to school or to go to the university.
But surely these, I mean, the MMR, for example, which has been very controversial, you know, this is three vaccines all given at the same time. And it might be, you know, might make people rest a little bit easier if they could, say, space them over, several months or a year.
Well, this is exactly, now I'm talking about individual choices, okay? I had to make a choice for my granddaughter. They were going to, two months, they were going to challenge her with seven different vaccines, which I advised my daughter not to, and to separate it. Some of them I wouldn't take myself, but I couldn't advise that she wanted her daughter to have all of them. And listen to this. They said, okay, we can, but the insurance company will pay for all of them if you take them all at once, but will not pay for them if you take them separately. So I decided, that we would pay and, do it that way. Because I think for a baby that you're challenging, you're overwhelming their immune system by challenging them within 3 months of life with six different vaccines for six different pathogens.
All at once. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot, isn't it, for the immune system? A brand new baby's immune system to cope with all of that is a lot. I mean, I interviewed victims of Gulf War syndrome back in the 1990s, and they were convinced that their health had been very severely affected by having multiple treatments and vaccines all at once, loads of jabs all at the same time, just before they got in those aircraft and went over into the first Gulf War.
Yeah, a lot of them came back very compromised from three things. First, overly vaccinated before going there. Second, from all the depleted uranium munition that was used over there. You had a lot of radioactive particles in the air that they were breathing. And second, I don't know if you know if that was an issue in Great Britain, but the burn pits where they were burning everything. A lot of soldiers became victim of the burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So is that sort of soot and dust from these places?
Yeah, they were burning everything together in huge burn pits from munitions to rubber to everything else. And there was a lot of depleted uranium in the air. And a lot of soldiers fell victim to that. A lot of Iraqi, I'm sure you know the story in Iraq, especially in Basra, where the rate of infant cancers went up over 500% due to all those all the depleted uranium that went that got loose into the air.
So anyway, how does it work when you've got these various vaccines that have gone through the proper trials and then you all combine them into one? How do you know if that's safe with, say, seven vaccines all at once?
Well, I would imagine that they would be testing them all at once and seeing the immune response to each, you know, measure the immune response to each one of them. That would be the way to go. But before the COVID-19 pandemic, we weren't paying a lot of attention to what these pharmaceutical companies were doing with their vaccine, how they were testing it, weren't following it that closely. Neither was I. It's only when the new vaccines came around, the mRNA vaccines, which is a new thing, and even the adenovirus vector with that mRNA that has been reverse transcripted in as DNA in an adenovirus, that we started paying attention and saying, wait, they're going to do it in 9 months, 6 months, 8 months. How do we know if it's safe? Unfortunately, we didn't pay that much attention before to the vaccines that we're developing. I didn't follow the development of these vaccines because we didn't have this emergency that we have now.
I know since the 1950s, there's been a joint US-British program, much of it secret, actually, of the common cold. A lot of this was done at a place called Harvard Hospital, just south of the city of Salisbury in Wiltshire in England. And I just wonder, you know, it does seem to me that the common cold has been researched and researched and researched, and yet for some reason they never found any kind of vaccine for the common cold. Do you know why that is? Because it would seem it's something, you know, if you can't get a vaccine for the common cold, you know, this is one of the most basic things. Why vaccines just not, do they not work for something like that?
No, well, I personally, I don't care how many vaccines they would develop for the common cold. I would never get vaccinated for the common cold. I'd rather get the cold than get my natural immunity, you know, up. When you get a cold, the reason that, first of all, you develop immunity towards that virus, whether it's a rhinovirus or an adenovirus. And for 6 weeks after that, you have a lot of interferon in your bloodstream. Interferon is a molecule that you produce, that infected cells from a cold produce, that tells other cells to make a protein that makes them become refractory to further infection. That's why usually when you get the common cold, you're not going to get another cold right away after it. And second of all, it's what you get as far as sickness from the common cold is not worth going to get a vaccine from a pharmaceutical company that you don't know what they're putting in their vaccine. So I don't think I would want to see anybody developing a virus for the common cold, which is part of the natural order of things. It's not that morbid, and it's not that lethal. So why develop a vaccine for the common cold?
But isn't the coronavirus a type of common cold?
Actually, we knew five coronaviruses, five serotypes back in the 70s. And I think I've told you that before. 25% of kids between the age of 7 and 14 were seropositive, meaning they had antibodies to them. So they were not that harmful. It seems that it's only when we started to get cross-species coronaviruses that the coronaviruses started to get more harmful. And that's what happened with the SARS-CoV-1, which supposedly came from bats. and the SARS-CoV-2, which also supposedly came from bats. Or, like I said, it's not really relevant whether it escaped from the laboratory and mutated. The SARS-CoV-1 of 2003 mutated in the laboratory and escaped the laboratory, or mutated in bats in vivo and then contaminated people through the live markets in Wuhan. The end result is the same. Because you can get, people are saying, well, we tested it, and the normal genetic manipulations, such as gene splicing, were not observed, so it didn't come from a laboratory. Well, you don't have to genetically engineer something for it to mutate in the laboratory. Just serial passage through tissue cultures, which is a normal procedure in virology, the virus can mutate as you pass it from tissue culture to tissue culture and escape the laboratory. And the end result would be the same as if it mutated in bats to give us the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
Okay, just to go back to the the problems with the Johnson & Johnson contamination, the mystery contamination, that they won't tell us what it was or what it is. Have countries taken this seriously, or is it still being used around the world?
Well, to tell you, this is a much more serious problem, because would you ever heard of, you would have never heard of a company called, Emergent Solutions, BioSolutions. We wouldn't have known they're the ones manufacturing for Johnson & Johnson and for AstraZeneca in Baltimore. Were you aware, Tony, that some of your vaccines in Europe were being manufactured in Baltimore, Maryland?
No.
I wasn't aware of that until this thing happened. And when somebody who's a trained virologist said there were some fundamental mistakes in the steps of producing the virus, so we don't know what are the mistakes they would have made. That is a lot more worrisome right now than where did the COVID-19, Corona-2, the SARS-CoV-2 virus came from. And when you have such mishaps in the fabrication of something that's going to be injected into people intramuscularly that you cannot de-inject, that's much more worrisome. And I think right now the main problem will be, quality control to make sure that there isn't something very unsafe in the vaccines.
Yeah, but since the government has indemnified these vaccine companies, what motive is there for them to have any quality control?
Well, hopefully not to get too many people sick. That would be the main reason to have good quality control. It is true that they have immunity from civil lawsuits, but there would come a point where people would really be up in arms. The other problem is that we don't know, certain adverse reactions may not appear until later. So the whole idea of giving them immunity, of giving the pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, immunity from civil lawsuits or criminal prosecution is a bad one. But then we see that all the time. We're living in an industrial bio-industrial environment that's getting harder and harder to control when the controlling bodies that are supposed to regulate them are being directed by people from Big Pharma.
Well, that's right. The regulators seem to have been captured. Anyway, look, Stanley, so if you want to get gas for your car, you having problems, or diesel or whatever?
Definitely. Very long lines, you know, and many of the stations are out. You know, you go
so there's just no fuel.
Supposedly, but I don't see how it affects Florida, because the pipeline really is from going towards the Northeast. I didn't know this pipeline. We shouldn't depend on that pipeline. Our main entry for fuel is Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale. But for some reason, Florida is also affected. All of the Northeast is affected. Most of the airlines are rerouting some of their flights because of lack of jet fuel, because this Colonial Pipeline Company also pumps jet fuel to all of the Northeast of the United States.
Dr. Stanley Laham, thanks very much for joining us again.
You're welcome, Tony.